You are listening to The Realish Report. Here's your host, John Friend.
All right, guys. Welcome back to another edition of The Realish Report. I am your host, John Friend. Joining me today is the Mexican nationalist Fernando Cortez. Fernando was the master of ceremonies at the International Identitarian Congress held from May 1st through the 3rd in Guadalajara, Mexico. The Congress featured a number of prominent and respected speakers, including Dr. David Duke, Dr. E. Michael Jones, and Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review. Fernando, welcome to the program, sir. It's an honor to have you here today.
Hello, John. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, very good. Well, yeah, I'm glad that you could be here. There's a number of issues that I wanted to discuss with you. And I guess just to get started, I've heard you on different radio programs. I believe you were on Renegade Broadcasting and also Red Ice Radio. So many of our listeners may already be familiar with your background. But I guess could you just start there? Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you kind of got involved with nationalism?
Well, I got involved with nationalism in different forms of, well, I guess I could just say different forms of philosophy that lead to statesmanship and different ideologies, not just nationalism, although it's the one I like the most. About 15, 16 years ago, approximately, and it all started more with an interest in philosophy and psychology, later in religion and the different forms of understanding the spiritual side of humanity. And through all those studies and reading, well, eventually you get led to politics, because all these things have always been very closely related to politics and how people want to run the world, or at least their community. And through the study of history, I started noticing that there were different versions of history, not just what I had been told in school, and many things that didn't add up in school. I started digging into them to kind of understand and have a better perspective of what was going on with the world before and right now. And through that, I understood that the main thing, although it sounds cliche, but it's very true, is that the victor always writes history, and that how things went down is always the tale of whoever won the fight. So many times what is officially written is simply propaganda, post-war propaganda. And through that, I compare that to the current situation of my country, and I started understanding what countries that are trying to develop themselves and don't have the economical power to do so, how they are managed, how they are controlled, and what they can do to get ahead. And sooner or later, I got to Germany's example, that after the first war, how they were pretty much starving, and how the Versailles Treaty, I don't know how you say Versailles in English, was keeping them up.
Yeah.
Versailles.
Yep.
Keeping them under the thumb of the of their surrounding economic powers, and how they were able to find the pride and the discipline to find a solution. And even though it cost them a lot of death and a war that was pretty much they were forced into, even though they try to portray it as if they started it, they're still standing today, and they're still a very strong economic power today, even though they are still under occupation, and even though they don't have an official army, they're certainly better off than what they were before the Second War.
Right. Now, I'm curious, who are some of the most influential philosophers or historians or statesmen that you were reading when you first got into all this?
Well, I guess a few that I could name would be Plato.
Okay.
Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, people that were in Europe involved in the identitarian or third position or nationalist movements in the 30s and 40s. It's sometimes hard to name them because of the way they've been bashed in history and the media, but you know, from Codreanu to Evola,
okay.
even Goebbels, and I guess a little from here and from there, but yeah, around that Mishima, that's kind of my main stream.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting because in my opinion, or at least in my experience, two of the most influential books that I've ever read were Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf and Codrianu's book, For My Legionaries.
Yes,
Are you familiar? Yes, yeah.
Those are two really good books, and I also really liked Mein Kampf when I read it a long time ago, but it really was years after that I started reading more and more about history and about exactly the position Hitler was in, that I could put Mein Kampf into a context and understand more of exactly where he was coming from and why he was thinking certain things and how he wanted to apply them. Because it's, I think if you read it without that historical context, what can seem a little confusing if you don't know the political and social and economical situation of Germany at that time, which was not very a pretty young nation considering it was used to be just part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Yeah, that's very true. One thing that struck me about Mein Kampf, and I guess for that matter For My Legionaries, Codrianu's book, was just the wisdom, the insight, just the powerful observations that these men made all throughout the book. And you know, people have this idea that, you know, of course, because of the Jewish media and Jewish propaganda, people have this image, this totally irrational and really just not true, that this image of Hitler as being this evil monster. But if you read Mein Kampf, I mean, he does talk about race, he does talk about Jews, but the book is so much more than that. There's so many other you know, issues and topics that he's dealing with that are just so powerful and so insightful. You know, it's really a shame that, you know, everyone's not reading Mein Kampf because it's such a powerful book.
Yes, especially when it comes to understanding the different perspectives that you can have about the problems of your society and how you can address them. And like you say, of course they can bring quotes out of context when it comes to race and stuff. They really didn't find any hate or any racial
supremacy. Yeah.
Exactly. There's nothing like that in Mein Kampf. Like if I wrote a book about Mexicans right now and about Mexico, of course I would talk about the spirit of sacrifice that the Mexicans have and how hardworking they are compared to, under the right circumstances, compared to other nations and stuff like that, because those are things that are true about my nation and about my people. In no way am I gonna write them trying to say that other nations or people are worse or that we have something against them. It's just a sense of pride and acknowledgement and conscience about your own people, their virtues and their vices. And of course the Germans have a lot of virtues and also have some vices, and it's obvious and normal that in a book like that or in a line of thinking that has to do with socio-political strategies or plans for your people, you have to take all those things into account. It's not a racial supremacy war like you're saying. It's just racial awareness.
Yeah, and you know, in Mein Kampf, I mean, I don't think that there's really anything that could be construed as supremacist, really. I mean, when Hitler talks about race, he talks about how the Aryan man is the founder of civilization and the founder of, you know, all the technology and architecture and art and culture that we see today. And I mean, I think that's just, frankly, a factual observation. It's not really, He wasn't saying that to be a supremacist. He was just making that factual observation and talking about why it's important to recognize these facts and to preserve, you know, the Aryan race and to champion it and to do what we can to better it and to improve it. So, I mean, I don't really see anything supremacist in anything that he said.
Yes, and even in that respect, this might be a little bit controversial, but it's the way that I have seen it or what I have sensed it for some time when I look into all those things that really interest me on how I understand the logic and the success of the political narrative of the NSDAP when it refers to the Germans as the Aryan nation, as an Aryan nation, and sometimes it does mention that it wants to create an Aryan nation. And in that respect, I kind of understand that, well, that they were still looking for the exact root and understanding of what being an Aryan means and what it implies, and hence all the trips they were doing to the Indo-Aryan parts of the world and to Iran and to India and to Mesopotamia and all the Nazi or National Socialists, because I don't like that out, were the National Socialist archaeologists and scientists just trying to dig more into the roots to understand why, in my view, the German nation, for example, statistically had more Aryan people than other nations. Because for me, I mean, for many people just see it as, oh, well, if you're white, you're Aryan. But I think there's a deeper meaning to that. If we use, for example, the IQ example, if you say that Chinese people, we know they have the highest IQ, or I think it's South Koreans, I'm not sure, but, you know, the Asian people, right? Just to generalize it for a bit. They have the highest IQ on average. So being, let's say, for example, it's the Chinese, because I'm not 100% sure. Being Chinese doesn't make you smart. It just gives you a statistical advantage in being smart. And not being Chinese does not make you dumb either. It just gives you a statistical disadvantage on being smart. So I think that the ancient term of the Arisanti caste or of the Aryan or the Indo-Aryan noble, I think that statistically in the European people, especially in the Germanic, you see more Aryan people, and I see the logic in trying to create an almost all Aryan nation. But I don't think that being white automatically makes you an Aryan, because I think that being an Aryan also involves certain values and virtues, especially spiritual ones, like the Wolfsgeist of Ebola, you know, like a deeper, like Ebola used to write about the Nordic phenotype or the Nordic race being the last physical expression of being an Aryan, as if being an Aryan had transformed over the centuries a certain kind of genes to express certain phenotypes that were related to being an Aryan inside. So, and many times when he wrote this on the public newspapers, and it came to a point where Himmler ordered him to stop publishing in public newspapers. But they never censored him. They never persecuted him. But they still wanted to have everything that Evola would write on their desk early in the morning to be the first ones to read it. They just didn't want him to confuse the public, because it wasn't in the interest of the German people. And I understand that. If you already have them disciplined and all on one ship about fighting and sacrificing for the better of Germany and for the Aryan nation, then why are you going to try and pull the mass into an intellectual realm that they're not going to understand about the origins and the spiritual side of being an Aryan and exactly what it implies and what it involves? So that would be like, yeah, so that's kind of what I what I think now that you mentioned that, I just wanted to make it, I don't know if it was clear or if it just sounded wrong. I'm not trying to be misunderstood here.
No. I follow what you're saying. I you're right. I mean, that everything you just said, I agree with. I think that you're right. I wanted to get back and talk more about Mexico. And could you maybe just describe why you're a Mexican nationalist and, you know, maybe why Mexico is so special and unique?
Well, first of all, when it comes to why Mexico is unique, well, Mexico is a very beautiful country that has so many ecosystems. You know, it has a jungle, very big jungle, a very big forest, a very, very big desert, and plains, and all these resources, gold, silver, oil, all kinds of weathers, all kinds of plants, all kinds of animals. And it just, its history is very interesting to me. It's always been very, very mystic in the sense that so much has gone on in Mexico and in ways that have not gone on in different parts of the world. Like, we were already carrying this particular baggage of cultural and genetic unity, because when Spain was founded, it was founded on the principle or on the strategy of unifying Aragon and Castilla, which were two different kingdoms. And then when the kings got married, they united those those kingdoms to create Spain, and they kind of united people. It wasn't as simple as it sounds, because it would be right now, well, I don't want to give a wrong example, but it did have its complications and difficulties. So then when the Spanish came to Mexico, the way that something that not many people know is that, well, the Aztecs were pretty much bullying many of the indigenous tribes.
Right.
The Asian tribes that were there. And
right. They were the most powerful tribe in Mexico at the time, correct?
Yes, many people right now, they say, oh, like Aztec pride and all that. But first of all, most of them were wiped out intentionally by other Indians or indigenous people, not by the Spaniards. And second of all, they were not liked back then, because they were the only ones with all this human sacrifice stuff and eating people and crazy stuff like that. So what many people don't know is that when Cortes started the siege on the Aztec Empire, the army consisted of 200 Spanish soldiers and 300,000 Indians. So this is not like the Spanish came and took over and started oppressing and controlling the Indians and then wiped out the Aztecs. It was all the Indians, they acknowledged the tactical and military advantage of the Spanish, and they asked them for help to bring down the Aztec Empire so they could develop themselves with freedom. And many people say, right. Well, no, they got fooled into thinking that they were gods and stuff because they were white and they were riding on horses. But that's just for anybody that actually has any critical thinking. That's it. You cannot imagine seeing a European man coming down from a boat, hungry, dehydrated, smelling probably like crap, like asking what kind of fruit he can eat, you know, and then thinking that he was a god. You know, they probably got down there and started asking them for help on where to sleep, what to eat, maybe where to wash themselves. If not many Spanish were into the washing themselves at that time, but stuff like that, you know, as soon as one of them has to go to the bathroom and you have to see him take off all his armor and grunt and fall and just, you know, the general discomfort of this distant travel that they were doing, you could acknowledge just logically that this is just a person coming from very far away, not a god. You know, the Indians were not, they were not dumb. So the way that Mexico was created is pretty interesting to me. And you know, when you are raised and when you are born somewhere, You get an identity, because identity is the combination of your land and your experiences. The land you're in and the experiences that you share with the people that live in it. So over generations, this identity is created, and you create a link that with your land and with your people and with your nation. That's why I am a Mexican nationalist. I would be a nationalist wherever that I would have been born, because I embrace that identity and I have that link with my land. A link that by the way, is shattered and is weakened, for example, when your family is hungry, you know, because the family, the blood bonds come before the bonds of the land. And this is one problem that Mexico has had with its identity, that it's been under the power of the liberal Masons, just bowed down to Wall Street as if they, in that case, yes, as if they were gods, and just has the people so poor and so lacking of opportunities. So that's why I think that's I guess that kind of answers your question, right?
Yeah, definitely. And just to continue on this, could you I want to talk about what it's like living in modern day Mexico and some of the problems that you guys are facing. But before we do that, could you maybe just elaborate on some of the more important aspects of Mexican history or Mexican culture, maybe, that we Americans really need to understand and recognize? What are like the most important historical aspects that were really not presented or taught in our school? Could you maybe address that?
Well, I think one thing that needs to be understood, regardless of all the sensitive people, a very little part of sensitive people in Mexico that might disagree with this, but the Mexican culture is a European culture. It's a Spanish culture. We are simply one of the last remaining bastions, I don't know if that's how you say it in English, of the Spanish Empire.
Right.
So, yes, we do have words and streets and things that are called and Indian names, you know, just like you have New Mexico and California is also kind of a Mexican word, and El Segundo, and you know, you have all that, here in California.
Many of the states in the United States are named after Indian tribes.
Oh, okay, exactly.
Rivers we have, and cities we have, and towns. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of...
Yeah, it doesn't really mean that there's a mixed culture, or that you guys are part Indian in your culture, because you don't need, most of the people in Mexico who want to embrace this Indian culture, they don't even know the Indian alphabet or stuff like that. Well, not the alphabet, but the pictograms or the tongues and stuff. So
right.
What people need to understand is that it's a Western European culture, and it has been sunk into the, let's say, the third world, because it's linked to the other question you were saying. Right now in modern Mexico, what people fear the most is kidnapping. There's a lot of kidnapping going on, and there's this big culture, like dark culture, built around the fear of kidnap. And that we have that baggage in our unconscious, and our unconscious, the collective unconscious, keeps throwing it at us, because people don't understand that our development and our history has been kidnapped, is still kidnapped, ever since Napoleon kidnapped the Spanish king. And when Napoleon invaded Spain and kidnapped the king, that's when we had to become independent. Not many people wanted to become independent in Mexico. The only problem that we had in Mexico was some very corrupt Spanish people that were stealing money from the king and from Mexico at that time, just in the tax revenue and stuff. But that was going to be taken care of. The king was already ready to take care of that, and that's when Napoleon invaded Spain. And right off the bat, Napoleon sold Louisiana to the United States just to show his power. It was a terrible sign of weakness for the Spanish Empire and for Mexico. And that's why we had to become independent fast, before Napoleon, threw all his liberal influence on Mexico. So we wanted to keep it conservative. We wanted to keep it part Spanish Empire, and we were hoping that the king would, in the end, prevail and kick Napoleon out of Spain. It didn't happen, but that's when the history kind of got... We were forced into starting to make our own history. So then after the independence, when finally Porfirio Diaz comes and starts putting order, this is the biggest and most technological railroad in the continent, and starts activating the best universities in the continent, and starts getting all this influence, European cultural influence from Spain and also from France and from different parts. The United States starts to think how they are going to compete with this and undermine it if possible. So with a strategy that it still goes on today, President Taft and President Wilson financed a Mexican revolution. They hire these mercenaries, Zapata and Villa, which is funny because I see all these Mexican Americans with their Zapata and Villa drawings and tattoos and murals as if they were Mexican heroes, as if they were a symbol of triumph of the Mexican culture over quote-unquote oppressors like the United States, when it was actually them who worked for the United States and were on the payroll of the United States and took down the functional Mexican government at that time. And when they did that, they created this very corrupt and very uneducated and pretty subhuman government that we have today in Mexico of just thieves. Whatever, if there's one thing that people will agree on in Mexico, like all the people, is their despisement for the government and how it's full of people that just fall asleep inside the Congress and just whoever gives them more money, just it's just a very sad.
It's that bad. I mean, it's just like total corruption down there, basically.
It's total corruption. Yes, it's very bad. It's all about money. It's the I've sat down with, I mean, some people want to change it from the democratic point of view. Like, I have some friends that, they team up and some of them are involved in this new political party in the state I'm from, which is Jalisco, and they recently won the cities. And they even offered me, I was going to be the director of the city education. In my city, but we decided to come here to California. So my wife, who is American, she wants to pass the USMLE test, and we had been putting that on hold for a while now. But they did tell me, well, you are going to take this office, but you need to keep your ideology, under the sheets and don't make a lot of noise. And many people that I talked to, they told me, well, you have been in politics for more than 20 years in Mexico. I talked like face to face, hands down with them. And they would tell me, well, to be honest, you're not going to be able to do anything, because even if you do want to make good things and go against corruption and start denouncing the people that steal money and all the things they do, they're going to tell the governor. And then when the governor starts negotiating something with your boss, the first thing when your boss wants to negotiate something with the governor is going to use you like a chip. He's going to say, okay, but one of the things I need is this guy to go. And that's how it works. Whoever wants to do something good that goes against the system of corruption and of theft, well, he gets put down very fast. So even though there's goodwill, people with goodwill in the government, they're very fast. They are shut down or converted into this this scene or this shadow or this atmosphere of theft and abuse of the taxes and of the Mexican people. So it is very bad, but there's really not much we can do, as I was saying at the IHR conference, because the government was and is still U.S. backed. So as long as as long as all the presidents and stuff, they keep joining all these societies like Skull and Bones and different societies of Yale and Harvard, and just get their script and get their narrative from the United States, not the United States, but the people control the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and the international economics, well, there's not much that we're going to be able to do.
So basically what you're saying is that the political class, the elite class in Mexico, is very much tied in with the elite political class in the United States, and these people are corrupt. They're, you know, internationalists as opposed to nationalists. They're all for globalization and the destruction of culture and heritage. Is that basically what you're saying?
Exactly, yes, except for the fact that I hate to call them elites because they're basically just thugs in a suit that stole the chairs of the elites and of the aristocrats and the nobles or the Aryans, and they have done it in all most nations of the world. Just call themselves elites, but they're just the worst kind of people. You know, if they didn't have those political positions, they would be people that you wouldn't even talk to on a regular basis, on a daily basis, because they're just so, they're just not a caste you want to be involved with. You know, for example, the politician in Mexico is the typical guy that you sit down with to eat or to negotiate something in a restaurant or whatever, and you start talking about whatever you're there to talk about, and he addresses you very formally, and he seems to be very interested in what you're saying and very respectful. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, he turns around and starts treating the waiter as if he were someone inferior that needs to serve him, and me, because I have money, I can, snap my fingers and clap at you like if you were a slave. Stuff like that to his own people that just makes you understand that they have no class, you know, especially me, that I come from a family that we were, thankfully, and me, I thank my parents for that, very well educated, and we were introduced in what it means to be a good person in your community and to have class. And another thing that happened to us is, speaking of the quote-unquote elites, is that they stole part of the banking system in Mexico, which was a more noble and normal banking system back in the 80s. And in the 80s, my grandfather had it, and then the political, again, quote unquote, elite in Mexico was advised to take those banks from the Mexican people illegally, and then break them, and then sell them to the international banking system. And that's exactly what they did. In the 80s, they took the banks from my family and from many families. Then they broke the banks, and then they auctioned them. But the only rule was that no Mexicans could buy them. Only foreign banks could buy them. And that's when the HSBC and Goldman Sachs and all of them bought the Mexican banking system at a tenth of what they were actually worth when Mexicans were running them. So yes, you are right with what you're saying, but they're just crooks. I hate to call them elites because it's not what they really should be called.
Sure, yeah, and I understand. And you know what you just explained, that's pretty typical of what's happened. And for example, I studied abroad in Peru. What you just described is very typical of what's going on down there. You know, these international bankers basically run and dominate the country. And this is typical all throughout South America and Central America and Mexico. So, you know, this is something that's been going on for a very long time. And you'll find, you know, parallels with all these countries.
Yes, and the ones that don't fall into this category, that don't bend their hands, they're being invaded. You know, with they find different, like Libya. I mean, why did they go into Libya? I mean, it's just they make up the lamest excuses for their economical wars.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it really is a way for them to enforce, this globalization paradigm that we're living under, you know, where everybody is, there's no sovereignty left. I mean, no nation is really a sovereign, independent nation anymore. They're all part of this international system, which is dominated and controlled by this elite class of criminals.
Yes.
Well, I'm curious, and I know this is kind of a broad question, but what is it like living in Mexico? I mean, I'm sure it depends on where you're at, but for example, where you're at in Mexico, what's it like living in Mexico?
Well, to me, it's a very nice place to live in because there's a lot of warmth and closeness and empathy among people. You know, it's a very warm culture, a very Hispanic culture in the European sense, but more from like the southern part of Europe. There's a lot of communication, and we don't really have this political correctness thing going on until very recently. Some of the liberal and especially the feminist groups and the gay groups are pushing for it. But in general, there's so much mutual understanding thanks to the genetic relative stability, but there is some, that you can just talk to anyone, like your neighbor, whoever you run into on the street. It's just so much trust, you know. It's not like, for example, I see the difference here in the States. Some people, they can leave their door open at night, and they know that nobody's going to go into their house because it's a secure neighborhood and the police is there, and there's just not so much poverty. You cannot do that in Mexico. You can't leave your car open or your laptop showing or your door open at night because there's so much theft going on because of the bad example that the government gives in first, and also because there's so much poverty. But in general, people are really, really close to each other, and you know, you can even, if you're talking to someone and you say like bad words, like something that could be offensive, right? Something about their mother or something like that. Just the tone of voice you use and the facial expression that you have, that's enough for them to understand the context that you're using, and if they're going to be take offense or not, if you're saying like to offend them or not. And that's something that happens when there's a like an unconscious, and not just in bad words, but in almost anything, just a smile, a smirk, or a movement of the eyes, and people understand what you're trying to say because there's this unconscious context that has been built over generations that you cannot find in countries where they try to forcefully assimilate people together, like here in the United States, where you can't really know what you can say to other people. You don't know if they're gonna get offended. You know, you don't know what their culture is like, what the word means to them, stuff like that. And that's when the establishment needs to mediate between people and act like as a lobbyist between the different identities. And then when you put that into the hands of the state, well, the state wants it to make it cheaper. So it wants to strip people of their traditions and their cultural values and their identities. But the problem is it doesn't have anything to offer in return except consumption and brand identity, you know. And that's why it just gives them a Nike and MTV and all these things to substitute their culture. And that's something that you don't see in Mexico so much. And that's why I like living over there. But, you know, when it comes to poverty, that's when it starts getting tricky and the problems that poverty brings with itself.
Right. Okay. Now, I'm curious, what do you make of the current situation, you know, facing us Americans, where, you know, we literally have our country being essentially invaded by illegal aliens from Mexico and from Central America and South America? What is your take on the immigration situation in America?
Well, massive immigration, legal or illegal, when it's actually massive, like is happening in the United States, it's always going to erode and chip away at the social fabric of a nation, regardless of what nation it is.
Absolutely.
So
it's really a weapon. I mean, that's the way it should be understood, is that this is a weapon or a strategy of warfare.
Yes, and many times people say, like liberals say, well, it's because immigration happens naturally. You cannot stop it. And while that is true, it's not the same thing as when you use it as a weapon, like you're saying, when you promote it, when you push for it, when you force it, and when you create the conditions for it to be massive, and that's when it starts to really erode the social fabric of another nation. And ironically, that's when the racial tension starts to build, because the Mexican, for example, in the case of the Mexicans, many Mexicans that come here to the United States, they didn't really want to come here. They have to come here because there's the Mexican government is just watching their family starve, and they see no other opportunity. And these people, they didn't go to school. They don't know about history. They don't know about the banks. They don't know about the independence. They don't know about the revolution. They don't know about the current immigration crisis in America. All they know is their son is sick, and the farm or the ranch isn't enough right now, and somebody told them that they could cross them into the States and that life is so easy over there, which is not. And so then in the States, they tell people, oh, another lie. We are responsible and we took stuff from them. We owe them all these lies to make that white guilt and they really abuse the fact that the Caucasians and Europeans, they're really good people. They actually have a, like we were saying before, a lot of noble spirits. So they always want to help. They're really good people. And when they feed them this false demagoguery, I don't know if that's how you say it in English, but when they feed them this false information, they just start giving more than they should instead of thinking of them. And that's how the situation is being created.
Exploited,
and,
yeah.
What were you going to say?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I had to clear my throat really quick.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do think that the Americans, you know, the United States is in a very unique situation. You know, if we were talking about a country in Europe, for example, the answer would be easier. But in the States, it's more complicated because there's so many different immigrants and cultures and identity already inside. So,
right.
And it has to do with how the country was created, and of course at the beginning it was supposed to be of European immigrants, but that started to change. And for example, right now I was reading an article about how China and India are already sending more immigrants to California than Mexico. And even though they're so far away, and in a few years, if the things continue as they are, there's going to be more massive immigration of Indian and Chinese people. And it's not that the Chinese or the Indians or the Mexicans are bad. It's just massive immigration in itself. It doesn't matter from where you send them. It's going to chip away at the culture and the identity of a nation. Even if they were Polish, you know, if there's or Germans, even if there's too many Germans, they're going to start to change the American culture into a German culture. And there's people that will not like that. It's not about the Mexicans or the Chinese or the Indians being bad or all this racism and racial supremacy narrative. It's not that. Just that the United States has to understand that even though it fed relatively from immigration in the past, that doesn't mean that, like Obama was saying the other day, that it has to be a nation that is always receiving immigrants, especially in the financial crisis that's going on in the world right now. The United States does not have unlimited resources. It does not have unlimited jobs. It does not have unlimited social services. You're going to break the country. That something has to be done now. But I think that if it's done from the aggressive point of view, like, oh we're going to fight the immigrants, it's just going to get worse. Well, what I think that must be done is to make the immigrants that are already here, the legal ones, make them understand that everything they like about this country, they're going to lose if they don't take a stand with white Americans against massive immigration. And in a few years, in 50, 60 years, this is going to be another India. And I say India, I give that example, because India was also one of the greatest Aryan empires that made this system of caste and just got immigrants from everywhere and just let them all in. And now you have over 100 languages in India. You go to one part of India, you go to another one, and it's like you went to a different universe, not just a different part of a country. That's what ultimately happens. And many people say, oh, and the race in the United States is going to be so pretty. Well, just go to India and look at people, because India is the many, many different racial phenotypes mixed there, and you do not see this exotic, different and very aesthetic expression of those genes. You already see a generalized, stabilized gene pool of Hindus. So, and I'm not saying right. they're not pretty. I'm not saying that they're ugly. I'm just saying that you do not see the phenotypes of all the races that contributed to that gene pool. That's a myth. You will not get that. If you want the aesthetic of a certain phenotype, you need to preserve those genes, not mix them. I mean, I realized that when I was like in second grade and elementary school, when I thought, okay, what if I mix all these colors into the water when I'm painting to get a super color? You don't get a super color. You get brown. That's it.
Yes. Yes, that's so true. Well, you know, getting back to, you know, what's going on in the United States, I think that there's two issues relating to this, you know, this invasion of our country. And one is the fact that our historical narrative has literally been weaponized against white people. You know, whites are presented in our history books as these evil oppressors that, you know, exploited Mexico, and we stole California from them, we stole New Mexico from them. You know, so these people, these illegal aliens coming into the United States, they're just coming back to their own country. They're coming back to the land that's theirs anyways. You know, there's that demonization of what we've accomplished, of what us Americans have accomplished. And when I say us Americans, I specifically mean white people, because America is a white country, a white nation. It was founded by and for white Christian patriots from Europe. So there's that aspect. We have this weaponized narrative of history that's used against white people. And then also we have this really Jewish idea that, you know, anyone can become an American, and, you know, we need to accept the third world into our country. We, like, owe them something. You know, everyone can come here and become an American citizen. So again, it's sort of another weaponized aspect of not necessarily our history, but really what it means to be an American. This idea of what it means to be an American has been corrupted and perverted by international Jewry. And there's a long history of this. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar you are with what I'm saying here, but for example, Emma Lazarus, she wrote the poem that went on the Statue of Liberty, you know, give us your tired, your oppressed people from all over the world. You know, we had a Jewish guy named Israel Zangwill back in the early 1900s. He wrote this play called The Melting Pot, and he was really promoting this idea that, you know, everyone can be an American. It's not based on race. It's based on this civic nationalist idea. So it's been very, American identity has been thoroughly corrupted and subverted by international Jewry, I would argue. What do you think about what I just said there?
I think that you are right, and I think that both sides are being played, because it's not true that the United States is that. I mean, I grew up understanding the United States as a white country, you know, with its American music, its American food, and its American streets, and its American customs. And I came many times, you know, as a tourist, traveling with my parents, and I would really, just like I like traveling to another country, to Europe or to South America, and seeing the culture and seeing the people, seeing the architecture, just learning. It's all very nice. It's all, and I like the United States in many ways, and I like that image of the United States, and it's really being deformed into this. Oh, everybody can be American and all that, and that's not true.
It's not true, yeah. Not true at all, yeah.
And they try to paint it as if everybody wants to be American and stuff, but it's not true either. They're just trying to make people be forced into this relationship of against the white people in the United States and against the white culture in America, as if we needed to bring that down. Maybe it's just my case. I don't know if it's a special case or whatever, but me, in my experience, in the 50 plus times that I've been to the United States as a tourist, I've never felt that racism or anything against me. I mean, usually I find white people to be very nice to me, very educated, very polite. The other day, the first day that I got here, I was thinking about that because I was arguing about that with a friend of mine. Well, a guy that I used to know from school in Mexico. He ended up being a teacher in Texas. He's a PhD on I don't know what, but he's very liberal. He's always talking about these things in the United States. And I was arguing with him against that. And he said, well, you haven't been in the United States long enough to understand this. And that same day, I went to Subway, and there was a white guy, an old white guy in front of me, and he got to the counter, and they told him it was a special day or something, so it was 2-for-1. He was going to get an extra sandwich. And he looked back at me, and he said, hey, come here, choose a sandwich. I'll buy you lunch. And you know, I remember my friend, you know, right there, I was like, well, what is this guy talking about? I mean, what do I have to live in the United States to see the white boogeyman like he sees it, you know? And they're just crazy. And then they tell the Mexicans all this stuff about stuff being taken from them because they have smashed their pride so hard into this submissive, complex people that with an inferiority complex people that just always believe that they're victims and something got taken away from them instead of understanding that they were once the strongest empire here and they were already planning in Sonoma with the Russian Tsars or with a cousin of the Russian Tsars who was actually going to marry the daughter of a Mexican general when and how to invade the United States at the same time that Spain was going to attack France and at the same time that Russia was going to attack from the east. So they have to understand that the geopolitical relations will always have to do with power. Sometimes you win, sometimes we lose. Obviously it hurts that we lost that war and we lost so much territory, but the United States just took an opportunity to confront a competition that it had when it had a weak moment, and that competition also wanted to attack the United States. So it's not so black and white as Mexicans wanted to see it. There was a war for many situations. We lost some territory. It's done. If we ever want to negotiate or fight that territory or buy it back, we have to do it face to face, man to man. We cannot do it crying and whining and accusing the white boogeyman of taking something from us. It didn't happen like that, and it puts us in a position of inferiority. That's where the racism comes from, when people see themselves as victims and as people that cannot see eye to eye. I've never seen this so-called white privilege. If anything, I see minority privilege and Jewish privilege. I see this war against the white people, and I think that's and now they're trying to censor their free speech and all this. You're really in a tough situation, but I think many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, this is really a sort of communist agenda where, you know, we see this all throughout history where these communist agitators, you know, sort of instigate and incite minorities against the white man. You know, this has certainly been going on in the United States. The whole civil rights movement was basically a communist Jewish conspiracy against the white race. You know, we see it in a modern context with illegal aliens where, you know, they're always told how oppressed they are and how evil the white man is. And it's really everything revolves around sort of, you know, jealousy and, you know, degeneracy and this victim mindset, you know, where these people genuinely think that they've been wronged when in reality it's the total opposite. You know, we have no, as an American, I mean, I am absolutely not ashamed of anything that we've done in a historical context. I have no problem with, you know, us defeating Mexico and you know, taking their territory. I mean, this is how things work out in the real world. We should not be ashamed of this. But again, it goes back to how our historical narrative has been weaponized against white people.
Yes. And this communist agenda that you talk about, or this red agenda, because it has gone way beyond communism. I mean, in Central and South America, and in Mexico, which is part of North America, they use the typical class warfare.
Right.
There, and you still see it in Mexico. There they used it like the rich against the poor. And the poor, you know, they're oppressed and they're poor because of the rich and all that. And they just want to make everybody poor. That's what they want to do. And in the United States, that didn't work out for them. So what they started with the Frankfurt School was this cultural Marxism, trying to get people against each other, trying to get men against women, trying to get blacks against whites, trying to get whites against whites, just liberals against conservatives and all this stuff. And it's working out for them. And even though the Soviet Union is gone, this machine that they started to create to dismantle the social establishment of the United States, it's still working by itself. Granted, it's been fueled by international Jewry, by some Jewish extremists who also have these agendas to just control and manage the American people in an easier way. And yes, you're exactly right in all of that. No, nobody should be ashamed of their history. If anything, they should learn from their history, and that's it. But you know, if you don't like war, well, you can check your history, you can study your history to understand how you can prevent a war in the future. But that you cannot come to the conclusion that spreading your legs and giving everything you have away is the way for peace, because it's not even that. It's not even going to bring peace.
Yes, very well said. Well, I've been very interested in this idea of international nationalism, and this was something that was really championed by the late Willis Cardo, who was the founder of both American Free Press and the Barnes Review, two publications that I write for. And you know, this idea that we're all unique, we all have unique nations, and we need to be proud and really be champions of our own unique nations. And so we have that on one hand versus this idea of internationalism, which is what we see being promoted in our mainstream, you know, mainstream media, our educational establishment, and movies and whatnot, and really in our political establishment. So could you talk about this? Because I know the conference that you helped organize, the International Identitarian Congress, this was kind of like a major theme of this, right?
Yes. It was the objective was to start bringing people together internationally, not in the globalist, forget your culture, your nature, your culture, your nation, and your identity sense, but in the sense of understanding that many of us have the same common problems and the same common obstacles, and we have the same tools to fix these problems, which is the nurturing and the creation of a higher culture for each nation based on their own identity. And identity, like I was saying, is a combination of your land and the experiences that your people have shared. So when you create this, that's when people can start talking to each other, identities can start communicating, and see how they can make the world a better place. You're not going to make it a better place by trying to dissolve society, but rather to respect different societies and to negotiate eye to eye, understanding that they are different from you and they will always be different, and you cannot mash them into a melting pot. So I think that this is a very important awakening that the world is having. I think that it's only a matter of time for us to grow and to be more. I think that in the United States, it's a peculiar situation because of all the identities that are already inside and have been here for many, many years. I'm not talking about all the Mexicans, but just so many, you know, for example, black people. We have a lot of black people here. They're never going to be white. They're not going back to Africa. And there's just something needs to be done, because this narrative that of putting them against white people and saying that the cops kill them and the white people hate them, it's so branded into their unconscious that I don't even know if it's going to be able to be fixed. And then you have the Koreans, the Chinese, the Hindus, the Arabs, the Mexicans. It's in no other place. Like, in you don't see that in Mexico. I mean, if you go to Mexico, okay, there's the white Mexicans and there's the brown Mexicans, and there's a very little amount of foreigners, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's much more simple, and there's already a natural and functional way that white Mexicans and brown Mexicans interact with each other that has been built over 300 years. So it's not like the United States can just pass a law and make it happen between all of these identities. But so something special needs to be done in that United States. But I think that one big step, like I was saying the other day, is to make Mexican Americans understand that the problem that they have, the enemy that they have in front of them, is a corrupt and low government that they have in Mexico.
Right.
The Mexican government that made them have to migrate into the United States, that took their land, that bashed and destroyed the agricultural system in Mexico, that's what we need to defeat. Not some white guy that took, I don't know what, I don't know when. That's just nonsense. If anything,
right,
we should ask them for help. Okay? Mm-hmm. Like I was saying the other day, if identitarians can understand, for example, and like I was reading this article from Bachman the other day, and he was saying that, he was hypothetically saying that if these governments corrupt, Zionist-leaning, international banking governments didn't exist and didn't oppress their people so much, people would deport themselves back to their country, because now there's a reason to go back. Now they have opportunity. Now they have a chance. Now things are different. And that's true. And that would be true with many Mexicans, and that would even be true even for the ones that don't go, because, you know, they're already, like, I know a lot of people, even white nationalists, that their daughters or their nieces married a Mexican. Now they have half Mexican grandkids. You know, that's something that you are not going to be able to dissolve. You know, we can't make like a South and North Korea where just and just people, you know, like I can't imagine like a soldier separating a kid from his father because his father is white but the kid is half Mexican. That's simply not realistic, and we need to look for realistic solutions, because we want the real victory, not one in a book. We don't want a novel where it says that how identitarians could have won, how the world could have been. We want to actually do it and actually take power and actually change things. So I think that making an alliance and a cooperation between Mexicans and the white nationalists in the United States could be very productive, and the only thing it would take would be the promise of the Americans to help Mexicans stop backing their government and help them bring it down. It's not like the United States doesn't do it on a regular basis, so it shouldn't be so hard this time either. But it has to be first ripped apart from the international banking system, because for them, their interest is for Mexico to still be poor, still be corrupt, still send massive waves of immigrants out. So the first thing that needs to happen is for nationalists in the United States to start taking power.
Absolutely, yep, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do right now. I mean, every single moment of my life is dedicated to this. And I'm curious, because really when I look at America today, and, you know, really my entire life, you know, I was born in 1986, I'm going to be 30 years old here in January. And, I mean, it's pretty clear, you know, taking an objective look at what's going on currently and what's, you know, what's happened in America historically, that we really do have a government that is totally controlled by Jewish interests, by individuals who are themselves Jews, or by individuals who are essentially puppets of international Jewry and this you know, Jewish agenda, this New World Order Jewish agenda. And I'm curious, do you agree with my assessment of America, you know, American politics? And also, I'm curious, what is you know, what is the status of Jewish power and influence in Mexico? I mean, is it a huge problem down there as it is here in the United States?
Well, it's different. In Mexico, there are very powerful Jews. Many of them own, some of them own monopolies. Some of them are very involved in government and are very involved with the people that are controlling the taxes and just ransacking the Mexican people. And many times they're liaisons between the Mexican politicians and the international banking systems, the International Monetary Fund, and just Americans in New York and in Washington that are also Jewish. But there aren't so many, and down there things are so corrupt that they cannot really have this control and hold on grip over things like they have it in the United States, because it's so chaotic down there. Down there, it's just a Jew and a non-Jew can easily, just as easily, get betrayed by a politician just because of money. So it's different, but I do see that you do see the hand of this international jury. And in that respect, and in America, like you were saying and asking, I think that more and more people are realizing this. I mean, it's not like it's a secret like it used to be. And I think that the way the world is going and the way that the international crisis are evolving and progressing. When I was younger and I read all about history and how things have come into place like they are now, I used to feel very threatened and to some extent afraid of Jewish power and the Jewish establishment. But now that I have studied more and I see how history works and how things are going in the direction that they're going and how they're spinning out of control, to some extent, I even feel worried for the common Jewish man, you know, the one that works, the one that doesn't really take his religion so seriously, the one that doesn't really look at non-Jews in such a racist and despective way. Because of the actions of small groups of Jews, they're in a very dangerous position right now, because if you go to any park or anywhere to do like a survey and you start asking people, Americans for example, about the Constitution, they're not going to know what to answer. They don't know. If you ask them the national anthem, many of them are not going to know. If you ask them what the America was built on, the principles, they don't know them. But if you ask them who runs the media, and if you ask them who owns the banks, and if you ask them who has all the money, they know the answer to that. So,
right. Mm-hmm.
So when the crisis pops, when the bubble pops, they're going to be in the same situation that they were in Germany in the 30s. But this time it's going to be global, because the crisis is going to be global. So what I'm thinking is, how are they not realizing that we are not the threat to them? They are the threat to themselves. They are bringing this upon themselves again, instead of sitting down with people like us and just letting us tell them where to back off and where to, you know, stop getting so involved. Because many of them, I think, just do it unconsciously. The Jew is just revolutionary in its essence, in its spirit. It's always stirring things up. They're always stirring things up. They're always pushing for new things. And many times, sometimes, they bring new good things, like in science, and then sometimes, few times, not many, in music and stuff like that, because they're always stirring things up. But if they have this position that nobody can tell them how to stir them, when to stir them, and how much to stir them, they're going to harvest the same thing that they have harvested for 3,000 years, which is disproportionate and exaggerated anti-Semitism that we still don't have today, but if things still go like they're going, we will have it. So actually, I think they're in a more dangerous position than we are, because there are many white, for example, white nationalists, Italian, Polish, German, Dutch, Mexican, Argentinian, that are already taking measures in preserving their heritage, preserving their genes, and there's nothing that's going to force them against that. So we, even if it's a small percentage of people, we have ourselves covered. We, and now that international identitarians are getting together, even easier, it's going to be even easier to do it. So I think that they are the ones that need to start thinking what they're going to do, but sometimes I'm afraid that they're going to make even worse decisions. Like
I tend to think that they're not going to back down. They're not going to recognize their mistakes. It's going to be, I mean, it's really going to be a battle for the rest of our lives, I think.
Yeah, but what battle? How many are they? Even with the Israeli Defense Force? That's what I don't understand what they're thinking. What battle is there going to be if there's like 5-10% of the population, if that, in the world is Jewish? And the most probable thing is that when this starts to happen, Israel is not going to want to be attacked from all sides. So just like in the Second War, because many people say Zionists, oh, the Zionists. But before the Second War, the international Jew was the problem that was being talked about. You know, the supposedly humble and very simple Jew that goes around doing his merchandise or, I don't know how, his commerce. And that's the one that was taking all the power with the banks and with the entertainment and all that, but they were not Zionists. They were more like Orthodox. They didn't believe in creating a state of Israel. They believed in just blending in with societies and living off them. So that's why so many people, including some members of the NSDAP, supported Zionists, because they had the idea of leaving Europe and founding a country and just living by themselves, and that doesn't sound so bad. That's why the NSDAP told them that they would get Madagascar. Stalin gave them a part of Siberia in the north, and the English promised them Palestine. So in the end, they betrayed the last two, and the first two, and they sided with England because they wanted, for religious purpose, it would look better if they get if they got Palestine. So in that sense, many people say Zionist as if Zionist means a Jew that wants to control the world. But if you go to Israel, many Jews, you ask them if they're a Zionist, they're going to say yes, because they simply believe in living in Israel and just leaving the world alone. And many, I think those Jews are the ones that eventually we're going to have to talk to, because then they're going to, I mean, I don't know if you've seen this video where there's this, the ex-president of Iran, it's Ahmadinejad, I think that's how you pronounce it. Right. He's sitting down with a bunch of Orthodox Jews in New York, and obviously the kind of Jews that had the power before the Second War, because they were the ones that got targeted in the war, and they are telling him that they support him in the idea of dismantling Israel, because the fact that Israel exists is a sin, and that they have been against this since the beginning, and that he can count on their money and their support in any action that goes for a peaceful dismantlement. I don't know, you know, sometimes my English slips away, of the state of Israel. So you see this division even now, and it's not as simple, like people like you and me that are really into these kind of things, and we want to find real solutions. We need to look at all of the factors exactly as they are and dig into the information and understand that there are different kinds of Jews. Different kinds of Jews are doing different kinds of things. They have their own battles right now among them. And that way we can come up with a strategy that is very fine-tuned, in the contrary of just trying to cook up a strategy that says, oh, against Jewish power. Yeah, but what power? What kind? You know, I don't know if I'm kind of making myself clear on this.
No. I think I understand, you know, the points that you're making. I guess my main concern and my main struggle right now is competing with and really dismantling the Jewish media, because the Jewish media really is the driving force behind their entire agenda. And, you know, frankly, in America, certainly, I mean, I'm an American, I'm concerned with what's going on here. The vast majority of people are literally having their minds poisoned by the Jewish media and by these, in some cases, entirely false or, you know, certainly majorly distorted narratives of our collective history, whether that relates to World War II and this fake Jewish Holocaust story that is just endlessly repeated and, you know, highlighted and reinforced in our media and our educational establishment. Or if it's, you know, sort of this weaponized version of American history where, you know, white people are these evil oppressors and, you know, we genocided the Indians and we enslaved blacks. So, I mean, it's really an information warfare right now.
It's funny because it was them who enslaved the blacks and brought them and sold them and owned them.
I mean, yeah, exactly. It's like literally almost everything that we've been taught in our schools is almost the exact opposite. I mean, really, it's that bad. And I know some people, you know, that might be new to this information would hear me say that and say, oh my gosh, this guy's crazy. But when you look at the facts and you look at history objectively, yes. I mean, it is almost the entire opposite of what we've been taught.
Yes, it is. And you made a very important point when you said about the Jewish media, because that's exactly where I think that we should, like the warfare right now is, I think it's technotronic and psychotronic. And I think that's exactly where we need to base our strategies in. Like, many people don't understand the power of words and the power of images and sounds. And for example, many people would think that the word spell has different meanings. No, it can mean the magic side, or it can mean the word side. But in reality, it doesn't have two meanings. It's the same thing. That's how you influence the mind of someone else through communication. And that's what they're doing through the media right now. It's basically like casting spells on people through false information and through very, very cautiously selected words. And I think the one mistake that we are making, that we have made this time, and our ancestors didn't make because they understood the power of words, is that instead of all we say is, no, 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 they're saying lies, but that doesn't have the same impact. Saying no to something does not have the same impact as saying yes to something else. So instead of just trying to point out the lies that they say, which is important, many people should keep doing it because some people do detect it, but we should have this other side, using the internet and using alternative media to say yes to new things and to different things that are the opposite of what they're promoting. So instead of basing what we say on attacking them, we should base what we say on what we want. And that's where I think that even the tools that they have created can be useful to us. Right now, especially that they are going against freedom of speech and freedom of thought, that narrative of American freedom and, you know, the land of the free and of the individual and all that, that's where we can start defending, you know, the right for people to say what they want, to think what they want. That's kind of what I was saying the other day, that we need to choose our words so we stop calling them liberals and stuff like that. That doesn't sound that bad, and stop calling ourselves, you know, the tyrants and the, you know, just have different words for us, which like I was saying the other day, that's what I meant, that we should start talking. People like us, you start talking privately, because this, we should do it as if we were starting a business, you know, brainstorming, writing down and just cooking up strategies for the media and for communication and start getting ahead of them in that sense and in that context, which is very important. Like you said, I agree.
Yes, yes. Very well said. Fernando, we are going to go ahead and wrap up here in just a minute. Do you have a website, or how can people get in touch with you and follow your work?
Well, I don't have a website because more than anything, I'm just a father and a businessman, and I've been concentrating on creating or recovering a legacy, a heritage for my children. And but I do plan to open up like a YouTube channel soon, maybe make a few videos and upload some stuff from the International Congress, upload interviews like these. And for now, well, you have my email, that's circulodabel@gmail.com.
Right.
That's C-I-R-C-U-L-O-D as in done, A, V as in Victor, E-L, @gmail.com. If someone wants to contact me, they can use that email. Well, now that I said it publicly, I may get like the hate mail and stuff, whatever, but it can be fun either way. And yeah, for now it's just that. But right now that my wife is doing all her American stuff here in the States, I hope that we can work together to relieve some tension between Mexicans and Americans and start trying to make a common front against our common enemy instead of letting them exploit the problems that we have with each other. That I'm not saying we don't have. And that they're not serious, but we just should think smarter.
Right. Yeah, and we most certainly will be doing that. You know, it's been a great honor to have you here on the program, and I look forward to collaborating with you in the future, and hopefully we can get together. I mean, I'm in San Diego. I'm in Southern California. You know, maybe we can go down to Mexico together and take a trip, and you can show me your homeland and all the great things that Mexico has to offer.
For sure we will. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much, Fernando. We'll go ahead and wrap up, and I will definitely stay in touch, and, you know, we can do this again in the near future.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope we do.
Okay, thanks a lot for listening, guys. We will talk to you all soon.